We have entitled tonight's forum, Entering the 21st Century, and what we want to begin to do is to think about thinking what this world is going to look like in 20 years. And it's something that often we don't think about, and often when we do, we think about it either in terms of despair, or we think about it in terms of some kind of optimistic hope. And so we want to begin a process that begins to look at it with some kind of clear-headedness. And so hopefully what we do tonight together will help us begin that process. Many of you already know Lauren Bombach, who is the geologist on the teaching faculty for these 3 weeks. And next to him is Paul Voss, who is a demographer from the University of Wisconsin and is a guest in the village for this week. And next to him is Jeff Townsend, who is on the volunteer staff and will be here at least a couple more weeks and maybe even longer than that. And this forum kind of grew out of some remarks that Lauren made, so I'm going to ask him to start. And then they have not decided that these things are going to be sequential. They may go off in three or four or five different directions, even though there are three of them. So this unplannedness has been planned.
Right. Thank you, Charles. I first of all like to say that I would consider myself science educator. And as I think about this realm of the 21st century, I think of it in terms of what has happened and what may happen or what could happen. We're in a very interesting period of time. I think most of us would agree to that. The kinds of things that are happening, as Charles briefly pointed to, give us a feeling of a brightness or a feeling of darkness. And I guess in that, to me, there's hope. And so as we look at these brightnesses and darknesses, I think in terms of the science factor, we're dealing with a common phenomenon called a crisis. We're continually bound up in crises, and these tend to have a negative impact on us. But I think that it's going to give us an opportunity, and that opportunity would be to make us aware, and as a science educator, I guess that's, I feel, one of my strong parts as far as dealing with students is to make them aware. The other thing is the implementation. And the implementation is a lot harder to do than as far as comparing it to the awareness. The opportunities then, as I see them, are going to have to be done in terms of the total populace of the world. I think we're at a point where we just can't localize ourselves. This particular country has technology, it has opportunity, and we realize that the effect of the technology and the opportunity has put a stress on the populace, on the resources, and in the living environment. So as I look at this in terms of the world, I'd have to leave us, I think, to begin discussion with a question, and that is that as we think about the populace of the world, the developed countries versus the underdeveloped countries, there has to be some kind of situation that will allow them to carry on. So I guess my question is, what is the answer? And I'll leave it at that and let the others respond, and then we can give and take.
Yeah, I should say that Lauren's discussion grew out of looking at the Global 2000 report. And as he reflected with us on that report, he came to that question, what's the answer? We don't know that we have the answer,
right,
but at least that Global 2000 raised the question. And so Paul and then Jeff will probably speak more specifically to that. But go ahead, Paul.
Okay, thanks, Charlie. I am a demographer, and I deal daily with population matters, very much in a domestic sense. I work mainly with the population of Wisconsin, rather than the more dynamic issues that face us worldwide. But I can comment a little bit on that, and I think prompted in part by some of the things we've done this week, in particular Lauren's overview of the Global 2000 report. What I did was went into the summary and pulled out just some of the population things that I thought we might use as kind of a foundation for the discussion. And I'll spend 2 or 3 minutes on that and stop. Population is probably the best place to begin. It's where really the panel that put this report together began. It's one of the things that almost has to be accepted as a given when you look at population and resource use and environment and the effects of environment on that resource use by a population. There is such a momentum right now underlying world population growth that it would be very difficult in a short period of time to slow that momentum down, to slow the growth down. That's the first thing that has to be taken as a given. It's short of some kind of worldwide calamity, massive starvation, or a very large war. There is very little way that the numbers that are presented in this report can be altered. Now, what are those numbers, and why did the panel that worked on the report begin with that? Well, first of all, if you know approximately how many people are going to be around in the world in the year 2000 and going into the 21st century, and if you know something about the per capita use of any given resource or the per capita waste that goes into pollution, you can begin to calculate a lot of those other things that begin to look very intractable when you approach this problem from a very global perspective, which this panel did. So this is a place to begin. The world population now, and we really don't have a very good fix on what that number is. There are many countries around the world that have never conducted a census. So the number we have is really a best guess for many countries, but it's probably around 4.4, maybe 4.5 billion people. Now the panel is using some projections that were prepared by the Census Bureau for the year 2000, some other numbers that were prepared by the United Nations demographic unit for the year 2000. It's estimated that probably using a medium set of assumptions, that is nothing too low or too high in terms of demographic change, we'll have about 6.4 billion people. That is an addition of around 2 billion people over the next 15 years. Now within that is some good news and bad news that I can share with you. The panel doesn't present it in exactly that fashion. But the good news is this, and that is that the growth rate of the world population is declining. Currently that growth rate is probably about 1.8%, and it's estimated that it'll come down a full 0.1% by the year 2000 to be around 1.7%. Not much improvement, but the direction is in the direction that most of us would, I think, be hoping for at this point. Now, what does 1.8, 1.7% growth rate mean? There's a really easy rule of thumb that one can use. It translates into about 38, 39, 40 years for the doubling of a population. That is to say, if we're now at 4.5 billion, let's say, world population, and we're growing at a rate of about 1.8%, that means in about 38 years, by the year 2020, we will have doubled that 4.5 to be around, 9 billion population. And that's very close to what the UN is projecting for the year 2020 and beyond that. I think they're guessing at about 10 billion by the year 2030. Well, that's the good news. The growth rate is coming down. The bad news in that is that it's coming down so slowly and population is increasing so rapidly that in spite of the decrease in the growth rate, the volume of population growth is going to increase by about 40% over the next 15 years. Today we're adding about 80 million persons per year to the world population. Now to make that number something that we can grasp onto a little more readily, I calculated today that that's about 200,000 per day, which means that if we spend a week here at Holden Village, during that period of time that we're here, there will be the equivalent of about a city of 1.4 million added to the world population. That is the volume of growth. And the bad news in what I'm saying is that the volume of growth is going to increase over the next 15 years about 40%. We're adding now about 80 million persons per year. We will be in the year 2000, according to this report, and it's probably correct, be adding about 110 million per year to the world population. Now, where will this growth occur? About 90 to 92%, the report, the panel estimates, will occur in the less developed countries. That is, in the year 2000, that 6.4 billion people that's estimated, projected to be there, of that 6.4, about 5 billion will reside in what are called the less developed countries, or the poor countries, or the have-not countries. Many of these are the countries with the least levels of education, the highest levels of unemployment and underemployment, highest rates of malnutrition, more frequent food shortages, highest rates of infant mortality, low life expectancy, the poorer countries of the world. In addition to about 92% of that growth accruing in those areas, most of it will also occur in the cities. Now, this is due to two factors. One, it's due to the fact that the birth rate is high both in the cities in the developing world as well as in the rural areas. But it's also true that the rural areas are giving up much of their population right now to the cities that are already overcrowded in much of the third world. And this mustn't be construed as somehow a repetition of the course of modernization that the developed world went through. It's very much different from that. It's very much different from Western Europe or the course of urbanization in this country. And it's different in two respects. For one thing, the opportunities for work do not exist in the cities for many of the people coming from the countryside. They just are not there. And you end up having tens of thousands of people living on the outskirts of these cities, a reversed kind of role. Much of our poverty is within the central core of the cities. In much of the third world, that poverty is on the periphery of the city. But very little opportunity for meaningful employment for those people. So they're compounding, through their migration, problems that already exist on a very serious scale. The other reason why it's somewhat different is that that migration is not depopulating the countryside. That is, it's not bringing some equilibrium to the need for people in agriculture and the surplus labor that's there. There is a great deal of unused labor in the rural areas. There is a high birth rate. There is a movement from people from rural areas to the cities in the least developed countries, and they're not really relieving that pressure in the rural areas because the birth rate is so high. So that the problems accompanying this migration to the cities and the growth in the cities are really much different than the urbanization that occurred in the now modern world. If you can imagine this, cities, Mexico City, for example, is projected to have a population of 30 million by the year 2000. That's three times the greater New York City population right now. Other cities, Calcutta is projected to have about 20 billion. Bombay, Cairo, Jakarta, Seoul, Delhi, Manila, Tehran, Karachi. All cities that by the year 2000 will have between 10 and 20 million people. People that those cities are really unable to accommodate, the presence of the increasing numbers of people really is going to be translated into increasing human misery, into political unrest. Not a good situation. It's tough to live the politics of hope under these conditions. I think that all of us are led very quickly along a path of despair when we take the numbers and forget some of the other things that we've talked about. There's much more that can be said, and I'll say that if we get to it. Lee Griffin has shared this week a lot of things concerning the literature and the basic, what's called the transformation literature right now, using in particular Alvin Toffler's Third Wave. There is a lot that can be said about demographic dynamics these days that reflects this maelstrom that, to use Lee's word, really, that we're in right now, that the waves of the second, the waves of the second wave splashing against the oncoming waves of the third wave. But that I will say, I want to share very quickly two things, and that is that again on the good news side of things, there are two things that we can point to worldwide that bode well, I think, population wise, demographically. One is that 20 years ago, no country save for India had a coherent population policy that was directed toward relieving the population pressure somehow from the position of central government, trying to influence the trajectory that the country was on demographically. It's tough to point now to a country in the world, especially within the developing world, that does not have some kind of a coherent and deliberate population policy where there is funding going into programs designed to relieve population pressure in that country. And while the countries that have succeeded are few in number and tend to be small countries, we can point to very quickly to some small developing countries that have seen marvelous success in bringing down their birth rates and thereby bringing down the growth rates of those countries. So in terms of awareness of the problem and policies designed to alleviate that problem, there is good news. The other bit of good news is that within the last 5 years or so, demographers have come to agree on the fact that the birth rate worldwide probably has begun to come down. Some demographers have said this is the case for about the last 20 years. They had few of their colleagues agreeing with them. Now it is a general consensus that the world birth rate is going down. It still is very high, and it's going to come down very slowly, save for some cataclysmic kind of event that will either bring the birth rate down because people are unable to procreate, or it will bring the death rate up very quickly, and that will quickly reduce the growth rates in the world. So that's the good news. The bad news I see in all of this, and it certainly is present in this report, is that in spite of the good news, the gap between the more developed nations and the less developed nations, by whatever measure one can point to, is increasing. And that is cause for despair among many people. I would like to say more about that, but I've already said too much, so I'm going to pause at this time and let Jeff continue.
All right. My background, I just graduated with a Master of Environmental Management degree from Duke University School of Forestry and Environmental Studies. I had studied the Global 2000 report in some detail, including the technical volume, from a professor that is involved with international natural resource issues, heading up some natural resource programs in Sudan and Sri Lanka and a number of other places. I wouldn't like to take over Paul's domain, but in looking over the Global 2000 report, there is a very multidisciplinary aspect to it, and that population factors enter into so much of these trends. Once again, the Global 2000 report is a set of projections rather than predictions. The year 2000, there's no magical number about it. It's a nice round number, but its selection is about as imprecise as some of these figures, and as far as the Global 2000 really goes toward the trends that we will see, and therefore they project from the past and what's happening currently into a certain forward-looking date, and that's the year 2000. Paul mentioned the demographic aspects of it, and it's really important in that there are three revolutions. When you think about revolutions in this different sense, there was a vital revolution, which is that of natality. There's more people recently. The mobility revolution, as Paul mentioned, the migration from the rural to the urban areas, and also the consumptive revolution. We are just utilizing more resources, more people utilizing more resources. Paul covered the first two, and I hope to shed a little bit of light and some numbers, some data on the natural resource end of it and all resources. There are some assumptions that the Global 2000 made. One is that the Earth, both the land and resources, are finite. And also that we, at some point, we must reach ZPG, zero population growth. Now, the estimates vary very widely from a current estimate of the population now at about 4.3 billion, I believe. By the year 2000, 6 1/3 billion. And they feel that this upper limit that the Earth can support, some say 12 billion, that's only twice as much as the year 2000. He said population doubles in approximately 35 years. So in 2035, we might reach that absolute limit. Some, if you want some good news, some say 30 billion. Of course, some would say that 4.3 billion is too much now. And in some aspects, I agree with that. It is not so much the absolute numbers, but the distribution of those numbers. One thing that has to do with many aspects, both resources, the population, and the culture, and that's some kind of figure of the quality of life. And I'll just draw this real quickly. Quality of life is somewhat akin to the amount of resources you have divided by the population to some factor that's like 2 squared or, you know, times your culture. Now, culture being, well, normatively speaking, more advanced or less advanced. Now, this factor, this n, is this distributional aspect in that if it is, get my notes, if it is less than 1, you have a low population density. If it's about 1, some medium population density, and greater than 1 is a high population density. And it just, formulas tend to throw even me off, but if you look at it, it kind of makes sense. The higher this number is, the greater this number on the bottom is going to be. And when you divide your resources by a larger population, multiplied by whatever culture you'll have, quality of life is going to diminish. And so population density really enters into it in the consumptive patterns of your resources. A few statistics. The staff that put together Global 2000, in the area of food and nourishment, they estimate that about 12% of the Earth's population is malnourished, and only 3% in the more developed countries. Now, you might wonder how you can be malnourished in the more developed countries. Overnourishment is also a form of malnourishment. So they looked at both of those aspects. Yet there is some good news in that there is 20% more food per person than there was 20 years ago. There has been recently a 2.5% per year increase in food production. Some bad news. There's no storehouse, no stocking, no buffering, so we're very close to starvation. They say we have only a 30 to 90 day lead in the amount of food stores that we have. And that's one harvest. If globally we have bad weather, that's going to affect many, many people and many nations. Again, the distribution of the people enters in here, and that you have a problem in distributing that food rather than absolute numbers. So the problem at this point really has to be solved at home in the individual nations as far as food crops to support their people versus cash crops. Naturally, there would be some balance between the two because you cannot grow certain foods to support a good balance nutritional requirement in some nations. And so you need the cash crop to trade for that. In resources per se, such as metals, minerals, grazing land, forests, the forests of the world are in a bad situation now, and it's affecting many other aspects of it. There is massive destruction in many areas by the cutting by men of the forests in the world, particularly in the large forest reserves of Brazil. They estimate that up to the size, half the size of California is lost in forest land each year. Wood is one of the fastest rising commodities on world trade, and most of that is really in the world today. There is 60 to 80% of the energy source is wood. That wood that comes from the Pacific Northwest up here, such as for pulp and building materials, is a very minor percent of that. A critical issue in many lesser developed countries is wood for energy to cook their foods, to heat their homes. Grazing land is also decreasing. Nomadic areas in desert areas, the populations are increasing, puts an increasing load on a very fragile system. Desertification and salinization of lands is causing previous grazing and arable lands into deserts. In water, most of it is used for irrigation rather than just drinking water, as has been said earlier in other forums. But it is especially important in the semi-arid areas, such as most of the United States is in semi-arid lands, at least in the west, western U.S. And 80 to 90% of use of water in those areas goes for irrigation to support plants. Minerals, we know that about minerals, what we knew in about 1950 about oil and gas, and that we'll be importing more, the U.S. will be importing more than 50% of minerals such as iron, copper, lead, tin, and chromium. The lesser developed countries now don't have the capital yet to develop their extractive industries into the whole process. In other words, not only extracting the minerals, but also the refining and the finished goods. And so there's that distributional problem of the raw materials to the finished goods. I suppose I could go on about other resources, but unless there are some particular interests, I'll just wait for those questions and answer the more specifics if anyone has a question in particular.
Okay, one of the things that happens to us, I think, every time we get into the things that, like the issues that are raised by Global 2000, is that we tend to get overwhelmed. And I would guess that it's very hard for anyone here to you know, argue with the kinds of statistics and maybe even some of the conclusions that Lauren and Paul and Jeff have mentioned. But I think maybe one of the most helpful things for us in a forum would be to ask ourselves, out of our faith position and out of beginning to see ourselves in a global perspective as the baptized people of God who have been called in our creation and in our redemption to care for the earth, what, you know, what feelings, what reactions, what comments do we want to make in the light of all of this? And that doesn't preclude you asking them clarification questions, but I would be just interested in thinking that maybe that's the way to begin our discussion is, you know, where does this leave you? What remarks do you want to make? What, you know, anybody have any response?
I hear all of that. I feel mighty small when I'm in this area by the side of the mountains. I don't know what, I don't think I can fathom it at all. I think my life is so short that I won't be anything that will make any difference regardless of what I say.
Okay, I think that's a very common response. Renee?
I get the feeling from those kinds of reports that it's all something that's completely out of control and it just is happening naturally. And I think to a large extent that that's not true, that there's forces behind it that are causing things to go in that direction, and there's a small group of people that are benefiting from it. One example, I was thinking when we were talking about population and the move to the cities in the third world, I can't speak for very many countries, but I know the story behind the population moving to Korea, and it was very definitely planned. It was a government effort. They lowered the price of rice so low that it put farmers out of business, forcing them into the cities, which was part of an effort to get a pool of cheap labor in Seoul in particular to work in the factories. Now, everybody couldn't work, but the fact that there were enough people there, they could be law workers. So if anybody tried to organize a labor union, they were out and they pulled somebody else in. So it was a very conscious effort by a few large multinationals that went into that country to, you know, have profit motives. And I think those kinds of things are really important to understand when we start talking about solutions.
Okay, does anybody want to respond to amen that? Or?
Just one comment quickly. Richard Barnett, in his book Lean Years, talks about those who are not living the politics of hope, but living the politics of scarcity and benefiting greatly by it. It's an interesting book. So your point is, you're well taken.
Okay, George, back here, and then we'll come here. George?
You spoke of, I think each of you spoke of notions of good news and bad news. I'd like to ask all of you that brought up the notion, like in the last 5 years, the dropping of the rate of increase in population growth. How, or has this been factored in to global 2000 estimates and stuff like that? Maybe Jeff would be able to respond to that a little better. You know, you mentioned that it's now become commonly agreeable among demographers that that is a phenomenon that's occurring. Would you like to elaborate a little more on maybe why, some of the reasons behind that phenomenon, Paul, and then maybe Jeff can add a little later to the actuality or whether that is a consensus or an adaptation to the 2000 report.
Go ahead. Real quickly, I'll let Paul answer to perhaps the why and the reasons and what have you, but the Global 2000 figured an average annual growth rate between 1950 and 1975 at about 1.9%. In their projections of the Global 2000, they took three figures rather than just one. From 75 to the year 2000. Their high was a 2.0, their mid was 1.8, which is slightly less than the previous trend, and their low was 1.5%. And I'm not sure, Paul, what you said recent estimates were.
Well, I was just checking to see on the assumptions they use demographically and the demographic model, whether that pertained to the world or to the developing countries, and it really looks like it pertains to the developing countries. They did factor that in, is the answer. Their demographic model projects that by the year 2000, the average number of children in the less developed countries will move from about 4.3 per woman, per family, to about 3.3. That is a reduction of one child per family over the really 25 years at this outlook span. They were looking 75 years to the year 2000. We're almost up to 1985 now. They did add, however, that recent demographic projections, they added this as a footnote, that it was not part of their model and not part of their conclusion. They said that recent evidence shows that they may be a little bit pessimistic on the improvements that can be made in the birth rate and growth rates, and they indicate that in fact instead of 6.34 or 4.3, whatever it was, billion in the year 2000, billion population in the year 2000, it might only be 6.2 or 6.25. Improving on the model that they use by factoring in a slightly faster decrease in fertility is not going to change the general conclusion very much. But they did take that into consideration.
Okay, Al, you had something before?
Yeah, this is hardly a new problem that we're attacking. I can remember discussing this in high school 50 years ago. I'm almost 70 years old. I can remember 50 years ago discussing the same kind of problem. And it's come up repeatedly in political activity since. And no one, so it's not a new problem. We should be doing something about it today. We're not doing anything about the problem today, and we're worrying about what we're going to do about it 35 years from now. We're going to do the same thing about it 35 years from now that we're doing about it today. We're going to sit down and talk about it. This is not a problem that anyone is going to really attack. Our standards of living are going to decrease in this country down to very low levels. There's going to be a wide division between the haves and the have-nots, and it's a natural thing in our form of living that we're going through. Talking about it isn't going to, and no one has a handle on it internationally. It's an international problem and no one has a handle on it. You're not going to do anything about it. And the good news is that somebody's going to come up with a birth control pill that's going to be equally effective for men and women.
But I wonder about the food. Since we have more population and less food, how is that going to affect the nation?
Yeah. As I said before, the Green Revolution that they talked about in the early 70s, the advances genetically and by crossing strains and by picking out the healthiest pine tree to seed a whole forest or something, the gains there are some pluses and minuses. But the overall picture is, yes, the amount of the best arable land right now is really already used up. There will be minor gains in that, about 4%. There's going to be a real problem in feeding them. Not so much in the gains in productivity would be able to help it, at least through the year 2000, but the distribution of it and the consumption patterns right now. The more developed countries' consumption of vast amounts of, or the use of great amounts of land to support beef and meat, which is a poor energy conversion. Now, don't be misled, humans can't eat certain amount of scrub and grasses and things like that, so there will be some other balance between meat production and other fibers. But to answer your question, in general, the food problem is going to be a big problem, but it's going to be really a matter of distribution.
I have to agree with the old gentleman over there, around my age. I've heard this before. I don't know where, I guess I could leave because I just come in where it started. I've heard in our own nation in the 50s, beginning in just after World War II, I was involved in things as a fruit grower representing our district or our area in the Soil Conservation District program conserving soil and water resources, forestry, and all the rest of it. We worked with the various agencies. And at that time, if you wanted to be hooted and laughed at, just proposed that we take some of these super duper pooper highways that we've got and make some crooks and turns in them and avoid destroying some of the finest farmland in our nation. Everybody thinks what a wonderful thing it is to go from here to there and not have to even turn the wheel. We're that lazy. And we've gone through millions of acres, and we're doing it right today. Nobody cared about stopping it then, and nobody cares about stopping it now. And so we sit and shake our heads and waggle our gray beards and wonder what is happening to us. And I think that Christian people have a duty. I think that God is sitting up there somewhere or down here somewhere, and he just letting us mess things up and have our way and stew in our juice. And then someday he's going to step in and he's going to straighten things out. We are his people, the sheep of his pasture, and we're eating it down to the crown. And we need to get on the ball, and we either are going to be a part of the problem or a part of the solution. I'm oversimplifying, I realize this, but I think that we are selfish. All you have to do, even in my beloved home, I've come up here for years. They got two barrels, one barrel for waste paper and one barrel for stuff you and I won't eat. And it goes on all over our nation. And I also remember we have a problem with distribution of what we do send out. You hear it all the time. I've heard it for 30 years. We've got the food in this nation. There's plenty of food in the world to feed these starving people. But when you get it to the docks of India, and et cetera, et cetera, there's no roads, no way to distribute to the people who need it. Then there's a matter, somebody mentioned greed. People who live on the misery of others. And they do that to varying degrees, but they live on the misery of others. And as long as that element is allowed to persist, not only in our own nation, but worldwide, we can come back here, see, I don't know if I'll be around here by 2000. I probably wouldn't have any teeth. I've got too many now and no hair at all. And I probably couldn't even speak, but we could come around here again, those of you who can, in the year 2000, and go through this same exercise. I'm not saying anything to be derogatory to you, gentlemen. I see your point and I know what you're saying. But honestly, I've heard it before.
Sure.
In a different way.
Could I respond?
Is this your speech you had for the end?
No. Well, I think you're absolutely right. That the inclination is to go on and let something else take over rather than trying to grapple with these problems ourselves. I'm not sure that that's what the scriptures have in mind when it says that God gave man dominion over the world. I think that we do have some responsibility, and I'll comment on that later, Charlie. But the point I would like to make is that demographically, it is certain that the world's population growth rate for the many millennia that people have been on this earth was zero to many decimal points. That is, the growth rate of the human population has been very low over a very long period of time and has been very high for a very brief period of time historically. We're now increasing, we have been increasing as a world population upwards of 2% a year. It's somewhat less than that now. But there is no question but what the future is going to see growth rates that are very close to zero, that are zero to many decimal points in the long-term future. Now, how we get from 2% to zero is the question that I think you're raising. We can shake our heads and wring our hands over it, or we can do something with it. But somehow we've got to get from where we are to zero growth eventually. And that can happen two ways. Either the birth rate comes down or the death rate goes up. And I think if we wring our hands, that it's going to be the death rate that controls how we reach that point in the future.
Is it possible to bring the nations of the world together to deal with this question? We have the United Nations that is about as intellectual as I'd be trying to run it by myself.
I can't answer that question.
Where's the answer?
We've got somebody who wants to say something over here and then here, okay?
I've heard it said that the countries, like third world countries, who have the highest mortality rate are the ones who are producing the highest birth rates, and that for some reason the population, you know, is still increasing greatly. And it seems to me that, I guess I don't know what we can do, if it's an educational program we can help these countries with, or we can help them raise their standard of living so less people die, so less people need to be born or something. Countries where many people don't live to be the age we are, where it seems that so many people, they need the large families so that they have the descendants. Is there something, am I making sense?
Absolutely.
Is there something we can do about that?
In 30 seconds, what we've got to work for, when you ask what can we do, is to work for economic development and social development in those countries so that families are assured that they have some way of living a dignified life in their older years without having to raise 10 children to ensure that 5 are going to be around to see that they've got a dignified life in their later years. Most of those countries that you're referring to, by implication, have no form of social security, like anything that we're familiar with in this country or any of the other developed worlds. Families simply must raise children in order to survive into their senior years. And when the death rates are high, they have to have lots of kids to ensure that a few reach that point that they can be supported in their early years. We've got to somehow cut through that cycle before much headway is going to be done in terms of the motivations for having children. Now, that's a gross simplification, but that's certainly a large part of it.
Okay, here. Are you okay?
Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, that really gets pretty much to the point that I was going to make. Or the issue that I was going to raise with regard to population in the third world countries. And I guess in terms of your analysis of the situation too, which I think is good to have that perspective from over a long period of time too. It seems to me though that I heard you saying that we're at a more critical point now than we've been ever before in terms of human history. And that just by the way things are developing, something is going to have to happen one way or the other. Either it's going to be, we're just going to react to a crisis that's going to come upon us in terms of population and poverty and misery and everything else that's going to cut things back, or we're going to try and do something about that. And it seems to me that I don't know, we sure mess things up a lot in the developed countries, but we have a lot, and I think of the biblical injunction that to whom much is given, much is required. And I guess I'm not sure that I would see that we have been given all this as much as that we have taken a lot of it ourselves, but still the principle there is of the important responsibility that we have.
Okay, Lauren wanted to say something.
Yes, I just wanted to just interject here. As a science educator in Minneapolis, I run into a situation where I teach a basic ecology course. And this involves students with no background, or students who have some background, or students who have different slants in terms of the ecology, and I do struggle with that. I guess on the average, in my class, I could count maybe 14 different cultures. And as an educator, trying to bring the news to that group becomes frustrating. And yet, as an educator, I feel responsible to make those conditions, make the students aware of those conditions. With the Global 2000 report, I have found that in the educational realm, even in this fine country that we're in, that the text, which I have decided to use, is for the first time having something on projection, dealing with the Global 2000. And so I really have to struggle, but I really feel that I need to make as many individuals aware as possible.
Okay, Bill?
I don't know how to tackle big problems like this, but in some ways, small problems can be tractable. I'm reminded, for example, of a group of the Caro Bakak people who were losing their land because the Chinese from Singapore would come over and buy their vegetables that they were growing on their land at very low prices. Then there would be a bad crop, and the same Chinese merchants would generously lend them money at inflated rates, which loans they could not pay back. So they would lose title to their land and they became indentured servants on their own land. And the Chinese merchants then became landholders of huge tracts of land in the most fertile areas of North Sumatra. And frequently these indentured servants, who used to be landowners themselves, would have to move off into the city. And here you have several elements of a number of things we've been talking about population moving into the cities and so on and so forth. All of this part of a lot of the global issues we looked at, and yet it was happening in one village. Now, with the help of one mind, these people were able to get together and organize themselves into a cooperative to begin buying back small parcels of land and returning them to the ownership of the original owners, and to reverse this whole trend, reinstate people on the land, improve their standard of living, increase the stability of the area. The church was also involved, and the church had just begun talking about how we can provide for elders who didn't have any children to take care of them, and whether we could somehow adopt out some of these older people into families that had younger people who could take care of them. Again, creating a kind of social security, which in the long run would have an effect on the population in that one village. Very small problems, very small area, but it was tractable on a small scale.
And perhaps the work of the church is to lift up some of those places where hope happens. Okay, Al, and then is there anybody else? Because we're coming down on time. Lee, and then we'll let each of these.
I've heard this spoken of tonight in the Christian point of view, and it's my observation, and I may be wrong in this, that there are a number of Christians, including Catholics, who are not particularly in favor of any birth control, abortions, or population control. And I'm not sure that all Protestant churches are in favor of it. And until we as Christians decide and conclude this question among ourselves, we have little business telling the rest of the world, which is non-Christian, how they are to increase their populations or not to increase, or how they are to suffer their standards of living because they're not decreasing or increasing. If we cannot clean up and do an orderly job in our own Christian house, I don't see how we can take on the rest of the world with any sense of moral justification or intellectual superiority over the rest of the world. I think we better settle our own house first. Our own house is burning down. Let's hang our pictures up straight before it all falls apart.
Sure. Can I take 5 seconds on that one? Sure.
Just in defense of our Catholic brothers and sisters, there's very little difference now in usage of birth control between Protestants and Catholics in this country. Very little religious differential. The teachings of the church is another matter. But in terms of use now, the Catholics are very little different from us in terms of use of contraception.
Well, that's very heartening. I'm sure we have the problem under control now.
Hey, Lee?
McLuhan suggests that of the literally millions of scientific and technological developments that have come our way in the past 60 years, that the first one that has touched the right brain and thus had a direct inroad into people's hearts and many persuasions has been television. And I was trying to recall the five. I only came up with four of those T's. They were the major T's in as far as shifting trends. It was tourism, trade, terrorism, television, and there's one more T. But out of those, they suggested that one of the heartening instrumentations, if it's well used, is television, that India and Africa will both have satellite TV within the next 3 to 5 years, and that some 90 to 93% of the world will be exposed to television. We talked a little bit a week ago about powers and principalities and the malus and seduction of television. I guess one instrumentality that I see that has the power to do in terms of an influential way some of the things that we're hopeful we might be able to do is television. Just look that up.
Okay, we're coming down to the stopping time, and again, I think we find ourselves in an utterly frustrating situation, but it's one that as a village, we're committed to work on for the summer, and to see if there isn't a way to rest an understanding of hope in the midst of all of this, and I just wonder if you have anything you'd like to throw out, and then we'll stop and let those who wish to go, and whoever wishes can remain and see if we can begin to ring some hope here. So, any of the three of you, Paul?
Well, I looked at the assumptions that went into this report, trying to say, given that it's a rather depressing picture, given that we've heard it for many years, it's not a new picture, but there has been only limited improvement in that. Where does one begin to get traction on this? I spend a lot of my day-to-day professional life making forecasts and projections. And usually there are really two things that a forecast can do. It can be very self-fulfilling. Demographers know how to make nice self-fulfilling forecasts. If you tell a city council that their population is going to be extending out in this direction, it's going to be growing by X numbers of people over the next few years, sure enough, pipe begins to get laid out in that direction, and water is brought in, and sewers laid, and lo and behold, growth takes place in that area, and demographers can pat themselves on the back and say, you see, I told you. But projections have another really important function, I think, and that is to point out what may be an undesirable future, and to give us some idea where we can interject ourselves and see to it that that particular projection doesn't come about. Now, there's a lot of depressing stuff in this report. All you've got to do is turn to the conclusion, and you look at some of the things that Jeff talked about. We're not on a very good trajectory into the 21st century right now. Now, that's not new news. That's important to emphasize. But nevertheless, that trajectory is not necessarily one that I think we would chart out if we were trying to chart out a course on which our children and our grandchildren are going to be living their lives. So where do we begin to get traction on that? You've got to go to the assumptions in that model. Two of the assumptions that underlie the Global 2000 study, I think, are not a place where we can begin to do very much. First of all, they say the assumptions involved in this report are that there are no major disruptions of international trade, the result of war, disturbance of international monetary system, or political disruption. Most forecasts make that kind of an assumption. Now, what that means is that we can't improve on that. They're saying that there's going to be none of this. If there's any of that, major political unrest, major disruptions in the international monetary system and trade system, it means whatever is a bad picture in this report is going to simply be worse. So that's not a place to grab a hold very well. The other assumption that underlies this, and there are three of them, the second one is that rapid rates of technological development and adoption will continue between 1975 and the year 2000. And that includes the kind of technological improvement that brought about the Green Revolution in many countries over the past 20 years. What they're saying is over the next 20 years, we've got to simply match that. That kind of technological improvement and adaptation, adoption is going to continue. I think that is very optimistic. I do not see that particular assumption as one that we can grab a hold of and say, well, let's tinker with this a little bit and we get a different endpoint. I think that if anything, they have created too rosy a picture through that particular assumption. So that leaves us with one other, and that is the final assumption, and really the basic one in this total report. And they say that they assume a continuation around the world of present public policy relating to population stabilization, natural resource conservation, and environmental protection. Present public policy is continuing the way they are. It seems to me that if we're going to somehow intervene in the picture that they have presented in this report, and in the end situation that they're talking about, it's somehow in the influence of public policy that we've got to begin working. And I guess it's in that area that for me, where my religion and politics begin to merge. I think living the politics of hope can't really be living a dumb hope. All of us know that the story of Lazarus and the rich man. I am convinced that the night before Lazarus and the rich man died, that the rich man and his five brothers could very well have been sitting in a retreat center talking about the politics of hope. If you look at our churches today, I think that's a very apt and appropriate analogy. When we look at the Exodus story, Charlie has led us through some of that in his Bible studies. For me, if you say, who must we identify in that story with? The Israelites or the oppressors, the Egyptians? I think it clearly must be that we are the Egyptians in that story. That when 5% or 6% of the world's population consumes anywhere between 30 and 60% of non-renewable resources in some area, that is oppression. And that is unfairness and it's injustice. When our national public policy forces countries that once may have been self-sufficient in agriculture and converts their agriculture to one that serves our dietary needs with the kinds of luxuries that we like to have during the winter, so that their total crops become exports and they become then dependent on other nations for their main food, that is not a good situation. I label that oppression in the broadest sense. For me, I'm not sure what it means in that context to live the politics of hope, other than to say that I guess I hope that God will be merciful to me. Now, he's promised that he will be, but I think he puts, if I read the scriptures right, or at least the way I interpret them, that the condition that God puts on that is that we proclaim Jesus as Lord, and that we live a life that somehow is consistent with that confession. And that is why I think in order to live a politics of hope, we must somehow begin to intervene in those areas, even if they're small areas. They can be small areas. I mean, you can work in one, it sometimes is called doing proximate justice, one small thing at a time, or the film last night, Grabbing at the Edge, where you can get some kind of a hold and begin working. But I think for us to live a true politics of hope, and to make that confession, we've got to begin getting on with the task. Just one example of that, and that is in the area of military spending in this country. $1.5 trillion over the next 5 years going to offensive and defensive weaponry. We've heard some numbers tonight. $1.5 trillion absolutely dumbfounds me. It is very difficult for any of us, even those of us who work with numbers all the time, to understand what that means. But I did some calculating today. $1.5 trillion over 5 years converts to $2 million a day since the time of Christ. That is, if we've been spending that amount of money since the time of Christ, $2 million a day, we would have accumulated $1.5 trillion. That's what we're planning to spend on weaponry in this country over the next 5 years. It also converts to $35 million per hour over that next 5 years. Now, I mention that because I think it's a good example. It's one that I feel very strongly about. But I raise it tonight on the eve of the large demonstration in New York City tomorrow because of the UN special session on disarmament, which began on the 7th. Many of our brothers and sisters, our friends tonight, are gathered in Washington, in New York, in vigil at this very hour on the steps of the United Nations gathered in prayer. And I wanted to acknowledge that tonight. I think that's important that we do that. And that's all I have to say.
Real quick, I should always follow Paul because I then talk a whole lot shorter than maybe not. As he said, the driving forces for the projections in the Global 2000 are, well, the biggest one is population. But it doesn't take into effect, as he said, there are assumptions. And there are some modifying forces that would mitigate some of this vast catastrophe that the Global 2000 seems to paint in many areas for the future. That is policy and technology. On the technological point, I don't think we can depend, at least from my background in the environmental field, that I don't think we should depend on technology to be our environmental savior in spite of ourselves. And yet there will be some gains in that area. In policy, to answer your question over here, there are some international groups working together under the level of the United Nations. There are some where the real work gets done in some of these agencies in particularly specific areas. One of them is called the Consultative Group on International Agricultural Research around the world, sponsored by the World Bank, the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, and another smaller group within there, are working together, are making gains in the particular production of plants native to those areas. Another area of international getting together is the Law of the Sea Conference, which is coming to its conclusion over about a dozen years. And here's where we can really let ourselves be heard, and I was particularly disappointed with the U.S.'s backing out of support for that Law of the Sea Conference, with its primary motivation being one of profit for the large corporations based in this country. That policy, that modifying force, and to go into what we can do, what Bill Rice has said, work on the small things. Holden, this room is a great place for awareness. We've given you loads of facts, hope to try and get you to understand some of these things on an overall scale: population, food, minerals and resources, ecology, just the policy, the whole gamut. This room is good for awareness. This village is good for living this politics of hope, living, doing the small things, separating your garbage. See what you're comfortable with. See what you can bring home with you. Also, do not forget the bigger issues. You can have a voice. This current administration knows the power of the retired vote. And you can make a difference for the future also. Everyone's vote can count, and that has a hand in the policies that are made. So that's the larger issue. We can work at it. We can burn both ends of the candles. Do what you're comfortable with, and be a representative of your faith.
Okay, we'll bring it to a close with that. Thank you, Lauren and Paul and Jeff. And one of the things that I would say as a preacher in all of this is that we start to pray, and probably pray for our own conversion, and not dismiss that aspect of what we can do. I don't think we as a church begin to understand that.
Mm-hmm.